Most North Americans live in suburbs. What happens when oil becomes too costly for the commute? Can we replant those former farmlands? And what about climate change? This is Alex Smith. You know, I record a lot of speeches, but normally I can't do the question and answer periods. Often, as now, there is no microphone for the questions. You are about to hear an exception. This dialogue between Daniel Lurch, Bill Reese, and Warren Karlenzig has information for you about your city and your planet. Here are the quick background notes to this recording. In October 2009, Vancouver, Canada hosted the conference Gaining Ground, Resilient Cities. As a shoulder event, the Post-Carbon Institute organized an evening with Warren Karlenzig and Bill Reese, titled Urban Resilience in a Post-Carbon World. It was hosted by Daniel Lurch. Daniel Lurch is the author of Post-Carbon Cities, Planning for Emergency and Climate Uncertainty. It's described as the first major local government guidebook on peak oil and global warming. Lurch has a Master of Urban Studies from Portland State University. He is currently the program director of the Post-Carbon Institute. Find out more at postcarboncities.net. Warren Karlenzig is the author of How Green Is Your City? The Sustain Lane U.S. City Rankings, the book used by citizens and planners alike to measure real livability. He's the president of Common Current and a fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. Another Post-Carbon fellow is Canadian scientist Dr. Bill Reese. He's the co-inventor of the ecological footprint, and he's best known for his 1996 book, Our Ecological Footprint, Reducing Human Impact on the Earth. That was written with his student, Matthias Wackernagel. Another guest in the Q&A is Bryn Davidson, a peak oil spokesperson and designer of eco-buildings. The opening presentations by Warren Karlenzig and Bill Reese are available as free MP3 downloads from the city's page at ecoshock.org or from postcarbon.org. Now we begin with the questions from host Daniel Lurch.
I'd like to mention at the beginning that our third panelist has not been able to join us, Anthony Pearl, with Simon Fraser University. He unexpectedly got called to be present at the inaugural conference of the U.S. High Speed Rail Association, of which he's an advisory board member. And he felt that was something he could not turn down. And I agree, because we desperately need high-speed rail in the United States. So instead, what we're going to do, well, first I'm going to pose my questions. We'll have a little start discussion off, and then I'm going to invite Bryn Davidson from here in Vancouver to come up and share a little bit about what's happening here in Vancouver, share some of his thinking. And he's been one of the earliest thinkers about peak oil in cities that I've come across. And we'll kind of add some local flavor to the conversation. I had not seen Bill and Warren's presentations before, and I kind of knew it was going to be wide-ranging, but not quite as wide-ranging as it has been. And I think that says something about both how exciting this stuff is and also how kind of overwhelming it can be. I mean, we've gone from Warren's kids filling up the gray water from the sinks to flush the toilet to Bill talking about fundamentally restructuring our governmental systems and redrawing political boundaries. There's a lot of space to cover in between, but I think that does suggest the enormity of the task ahead of us. My third question is going to be about digging into panarchy and metrics and kind of getting in more into the meat of I think what's really interesting here. I want to start off, though, with maybe forcing Bill perhaps to, I don't know if you'd be comfortable talking about this, but I think it'd be good to maybe get some balance in here. You've been dealing with these issues for about 40 years. I mean, you've been at UBC for almost 40 years at this point, I believe. And I know you and I have talked in the past about just kind of the frustration of, you know, we keep screwing things up, we don't seem to be learning. Obviously, there are plenty of lessons learned about how not to make our urban systems more resilient. But there must be some lessons learned about what to do right. So where do you find hope for moving forward?
Well, I think Warren certainly gave us a good oversight of some cities that are doing some things right. It depends on where you want to start. Vancouver prides itself on being a leading light in the domain of sustainability. And I frankly take issue with that. Vancouver is a highly livable city, and I think Warren touched on many of the reasons. Before that, we've had very strong public planning, a very strong negotiation with the private sector to free up a lot of private space to become public space. So we've created an urban environment that's so attractive that we're seeing whole families moving into 2 and 3 bedroom apartments in Yale Town and other places downtown. Now, that's a remarkable achievement in making a city an attractive place for families and creating space on the street level that is, in fact, highly livable. But when you look at what I refer to as the ecological footprint of the people who live in Vancouver, it's enormous. And in those terms, this is probably one of the least sustainable and most vulnerable cities on the planet. I'll get into this a great deal more tomorrow. But the point is, we have a disjunct in our minds, a real cognitive dissonance between what we mean by livability and what we mean by long-term sustainability and security around those issues. Quite frankly, I see most urban trends as going in the wrong direction at the present time. Asia, for example, and again, Warren mentioned there, was it you at the outset? Somebody did. Asian cities are all looking to the 1960s model of North American cities as the new model that they're following. Even in China, which I spend some time in, if you've been to Shanghai or some of the new cities developing in China, it will blow your mind. It's scary. But everybody wants a car. If you drive from the airport in Shanghai, or from Shanghai to the airport at Pudong, there's about 8 major bridges crossing the highway, and every one of them has a 200-foot-long or 100-meter-long advertisement for a luxury motor vehicle. That's what people want. Chinese cities are clearing the bicycles off the streets because they get in the way of the rising numbers of automobiles. So we're seeing things going in the wrong direction in those parts of the world with the highest urban densities that are just now beginning to jump on the fossil fuel bandwagon. And I'm told over and over again when I visit those places that until we change our ways and begin moving in the directions that some of the Warren slides showed us, they're not going to do anything differently. They will follow us wherever we go, and we've taken them down a dead end at this point. I'm not encouraged by the direction of urbanization in most of the world today, I'm sorry to say.
And that's actually a perfect lead into my question to Warren. Obviously, what you've been saying and what Bill has been saying are not opposite, but you're very, very different messages. I think a message of hope and a message of sheer worry and concern. Stronger words come to mind. So, Warren, you did start off, and it was Warren that started off with talking about Asian cities. I'd like to hear your thinking, because you've traveled extensively in Asia. He didn't mention this in his presentation, but he's traveled quite a bit and worked quite a bit over there, and you've seen firsthand not only how these cities function, but also how the leaders and decision makers in these cities are addressing things. How do you reconcile the good things that you see happening there, you know, the eco-city district in China that you and I have discussed previously, and other examples, with this message of overshoot, which Bill is talking about?
Well, the overshoot is absolutely there, and it is scary when you see the scale of overshoot. Dwarfs anything that we could comprehend. It's depressing, you know. What gives me some optimism is that China is looking at these 40 new eco cities, and these are going to be major population centers. When China does things, it does it huge. They have the state planning agencies behind it. They have complete buy-in, and it's very different than zoning or planning in the United States. In most Asian countries, it's very different. So there is hope there that they are getting it, even more than the United States in some regards, the resiliency issue. But, yes, the consumerism, the moving up the consumption ladder to emulate the United States, that's definitely there. They, you know, 3 years ago in Asia, a green city to them meant parks and open space. It was kind of like the 1970s conception in North America of what a green city was. And then I tried to, you know, bring concepts of land use planning, transit, you know, all these renewable energy, and they, oh, that's part of it too. Oh, and now they understand that green building's definitely part of it in a lot of the countries. They understand these other issues too, but the public doesn't. And that's a big issue there. So the media is completely different there. You know, they don't really publicize the green movement like they do in the United States. So there's a big disconnect there. But China, I think, will change. They have to change, and they know it. They look at the long-term picture in China in particular. They look at dynasties. They look at hundreds and thousands of years, and they're doing that now with energy, with the automobile, with water. I didn't mention the Tibetan plateau is 40% reduced, and that's where the six major rivers of Asia all come from. So it's scary in many ways, but there is some hope.
I just want to build on the scary part and maybe the hope part. Part of the Beijing area is drying up. Beijing may have to move.
Yeah.
I'm serious. This is not, we're not joking around here.
Next year, it's going to be the water crisis of 2010 is going to hit the public consciousness and the international media. They're stealing water from outlying districts and communities, or taking it, expropriating it, and bringing it into Beijing. It's a race, and they're trying to build a diversion canal from the south to the north, and it has no planned completion date. So they have enough water for 14 million people. Now there are, I think, 18 or 19 million people in the city.
And keep in mind, in China, if you move all that water to support the 14 million people in Beijing, you're taking it away from the 6 million people who live in the areas that you're drawing down to bring that water in. So China has inordinate problems. One half of all the new construction of buildings in the world today is taking place in China. And for the most part, now I totally agree there's a lot of planning for so-called eco-cities, but for the most part, Chinese construction is the least efficient and most concrete intensive on the planet. So one half of all new construction is taking place in China using concrete, which is enormously carbon intensive, and the buildings are not built to a high degree of efficiency or any other standard that we would accept for the most part. Moreover, most of that construction is residential, which has the highest density of concrete compared to warehousing and that sort of thing. So the impact of Chinese construction in and of itself, even if it's green, is going to be inordinately huge. And if we were really sensible about our own future, we'd be doing everything we can to share with China the absolute top end of our design capabilities, our building capabilities, to make sure that this one half of all the world's new construction is built at the highest possible standard with the lowest possible carbon footprint. But unfortunately, we're not doing that. I've seen at least one major new so-called eco-city in China. It's a catastrophic mistake in many respects. They've got the housing for the workers over here, the work sites completely on the opposite side of the city over here, and the way to get between them is through, guess what, mostly automobiles. So we've got huge problems to deal with, even in China, even with a lot of the eco-thinking that's going on down. There's been some spectacular failures that we could talk about if we wanted to.
No,
I'm sorry. I mean, you got to face it the way it is.
Well, let me do one more, and we'll want to get Brent, and then we'll open it up. Let's see. There was a slide that Bill showed that I would like to refer to. And I have to say, I'm kind of laughing about it, but this is one of the things I love about Bill and his work, that he's not afraid to say the hard things, because they do need to be said more and more. So this is the panarchy concept, which Bill talked about briefly. Fascinating book. As you mentioned, the author, Buzz Holling, is going to be here, I guess, at the other conference tomorrow. I have, and many of my colleagues have found a lot of inspiration in understanding, looking at the ways in which we understand how ecosystems work and seeing how we might apply them to other systems. I appreciate that Bill said that we can't really apply complex adaptive systems concepts to human systems because we're on a different trajectory of trade and we're extending and time and space, and obviously it's a lot more complicated than that, and I recognize that. But I think there are some lessons to be learned here, so I'd like to dig into this a little bit, and I'm curious. So there's actually three axes here. You can't see the z-axis, and if I remember, so it's potential, is the y-axis connected to this, is the x, and I believe the z-axis is complexity. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay. And in my own work, I have found it very interesting how those different concepts might be applied to cities. And we can think about complexity of city. We can think about the connectedness of cities. If you're thinking, for example, of your transit infrastructure or your street infrastructure, you can even think in terms of potential. I would like to pose to both of you thinking in terms of metrics, particularly Warren's metrics with his book, and perhaps the ecological footprint analysis, Bill, with your book, what are some of the ways in which we might perhaps operationalize some of these ideas to make more sense of urban sustainability? And I guess what I would, to maybe put that in different words, Warren showed these pictures of, you know, farmers market. I showed pictures of streetcars. You know, that there are metrics here that we use to measure what is resilient or what is not resilient. What can we learn? How can we apply some of these panarchy ideas to this stuff that's now happening in the 21st century?
You are listening to a panel hosted by Daniel Lurch, author of A Peak Oil Guide for Local Governments, plus the eco-footprint scientist Dr. Bill Reese and California Green City Guide Warren Karlenzig. At this point, Dr. Reese moves away from the microphone for a couple of minutes toward a graphic representing the concept of panarchy. I apologize for the poor sound quality, but Reese continues to pour out important information. Shortly, we'll be back to normal recording.
Well, it depends. You see, one of the problems I have with the panarchy theory as described in the literature is they talk about the system following a particular trajectory. So when you get right down to it, they mean one variable. And so what is the variable that we're talking about as we go up this loop? Let me explain it in a simple English concept. You can imagine a burnt-out area that is now being recolonized by seedlings from original pine forest, for example. Most of the nutrients are in the soil. The system is beginning to exploit those nutrients. It grows. More and more of the material is accumulating in the biomass. You reach the point up here where there's no further growth because it's a closed canopy. Competition has eliminated most of the biodiversity. So the system is in its mature phase. We'd like this. It's a lovely-looking pine forest, but it's extremely brittle because one lightning strike and wham, you get the whole thing knocked back. So it crashes, releases the nutrients, and can go back through that loop. But if you think about it in a human kind of context, where we go up this, our country is developing, it uses up its resources, we then go. So instead of coming down here and adapting to the new changed circumstances within the country, you maintain this trajectory much further because you can import all kinds of stuff from elsewhere and remain totally unconscious of the fact that you've overshot your own carrying capacity. Meanwhile, as you continue up this trajectory, you're drawing down the resources of distant and elsewhere. So what globalization is doing is enabling each country independently to rise above its regional or national carrying capacity while simultaneously drawing down the resource stocks elsewhere. So we all hit the global ceiling at the same time. That's what climate change is about, ozone depletion, and so on and so forth. And there's no fallback position. If the crash comes, where do you get the resilience that you need to recover because you've dissipated not only your local and domestic resources, but you've also drawn down the soil, the forest, the water table, you've filled up the resource sinks all over the planet. So to me, the lesson here is that we've got to reduce the scale of our operations. That's why I talk about a city-state. Because the regional scale is something you can get your head around. You can monitor the state of the various resource systems upon which you're dependent. You have some management control over them. And people are interested in the quality of that environment because now they're connected to it in some significant way. Most Vancouverites couldn't give a damn about the farmland in the Fraser Valley because they don't depend on the farmland in the Fraser Valley. But if we were suddenly constrained to, for the most part, live off the bioregion in which we actually live, then we'd be very concerned about every new development that's proposed. But there wouldn't be any new proposed developments. So your whole orientation changes because you suddenly recognize that you are vulnerable to the collapse of your own systems if you mismanage them in some way. So the lesson I take from this is one of scale. These cycles take place at many spatial scales. The human mind is only capable of grasping systems of a certain complexity. We haven't a hope of managing the world's climate. We haven't a hope of managing the world ecosphere. But we might have some capacity or sufficient intellectual capacity to manage regional systems. And if each region takes care of itself,
so that it maintains an adequate natural capital base, then the aggregate globally is the sum of all of these quasi-sustainable regions, and that means sustainability for all. But so long as we're thinking globally and not acting locally in the context that I'm talking about, we'll draw down everything everywhere, and willy-nilly we wind up, all of us, in the same sinking boat, which I think is an absolute tragedy, but it's precisely the direction that I see us heading at the present time. I had one more point that I forgot.
Well, I asked about how we have potentially complexity. We have connectedness. I see those as ways in which we can start to operationalize this concept of resilience. You know, how can we apply those variables to urban systems? Is it even worth doing? From what you're saying, maybe it's not worth
it. Well, I mean, Warren gave some excellent examples. Cities that had multiple, I mentioned redundancy is a major component of resilience. You see, we are fixated on efficiency. Everything has to be efficient. But when you get efficient, it means you eliminate redundancy, which is exactly the wrong way you want to go. So efficiency has misled us, because none of you will operate your lives efficiently. So why do we try to run the economy efficiently? It's an absurdity. We need redundancy. So if you have the option of cycling and walking and taking transit, then suddenly the car becomes unnecessary, although Warren still has one because every now and then he needs it to go somewhere else.
Go to the airport, go to Vancouver.
Oh, sure. So the same should be said about water. We need redundancy in our energy sources, not just one thing. We shouldn't be dependent 86% on fossil fuel when we're drawing down the stocks at the rates we are. There's a good argument to be made that the recent stock market crash was because of oil prices. We're going to see another one within the next 3 years as those oil prices tick up again to the point where the economy seizes up because it can no longer operate efficiently on those high oil prices. So redundancy becomes an inordinately important component here, and it means not being efficient in many regards, because it's much safer if security is what you're after. Efficiency is not the game you want to play. It's having multiple options to do everything, multiple food sources, multiple energy sources, multiple water sources, multiple approaches to healthcare, whatever it might be. That's the lesson I take from this. It's systems up here that lose their redundancy. They lose their resilience. They become brittle and very vulnerable because they're hard and fixed in their ways and unable to respond to changing circumstances. So there are powerful lessons here, but I think we need to apply them rather differently in the human context than we do in the ecological context, although I'm a bit of an outlier in that regard.
Thanks, Bill. Well, that's a lot of information there, Warren.
Very quickly, I'd like to bring up glocalization. You can do localization and be connected in with global networks through information. It's radically changing the way that human rights groups operate in this world. 20 years ago, there were a lot of atrocities being committed that weren't known about, and sometimes until days, weeks, even months later. Now they're known about almost immediately because of the internet and social media. This can be applied to sustainability, for learning, for communications about best practices, about what people are doing in their localized or regionalized sustainability planning and implementation. I'll be brief on that. But one other issue I'm thinking of now is that, did you know that in the Pacific Northwest, about 30% of your background air pollution, that's when, you know, the day's relatively normal and it's not raining or you're not in a heavy smog event, is coming from China. And that's because of the demand of all the products that we have produced in China. They're manufacturing them, and the air pollution is going over the Pacific and falling on you here. If you were more cognizant and the general public and everyone knew that kind of thing, then we all might understand that's a feedback loop and that we're part of that system and that we're not just, you know, producing or consuming without consequence. So I think that kind of knowledge changes the issue of globalization and brings it on home.
And when I talk about bioregional thinking, it doesn't mean that you become totally abstracted from the rest of the world. This cutoff here indicates connections to other systems that are operating in their own
lose. So this becomes a system of more or less self-reliant regional city-states operating in a globally connected network so that the communications of experience and management options and so on can still take place. But it's absurd of us. In this region, for example, you know, we talk about having an agricultural land reserve. But if you know how it operates, there's extractions being taken all the time as development. You go up to Chilliwack, and what's the other big town? Abbotsford. The signs on the highway, a good place to grow what? Corn? No, your business, right? Those nice big highway signs. Because they know that they can extract land out of the land reserve and pave it over. Fly over this valley, and you'll get... I get heart pangs because of the extent to which our agricultural reserve is being nitpicked to bits by urban development up and down the valley. That would not take place if we had a sense of our dependence on that landscape. And it doesn't mean we're abandoning the rest of the world. It just means we're taking serious stewardship over our part of the planet and maintaining it in ways that we hope everybody else does. Because if we're managing our region on a sustainable base and building up the natural capital, and others are doing the same thing, then in the aggregate, the globe becomes sustainable. But the way we're working now is that every region has an incentive to deplete its own assets and sell off any surpluses to other areas that have already depleted theirs. So we're doing precisely the wrong thing to break out of the kind of cycle here that would take us all down simultaneously.
All right. Well, I think that's a great point at which to move to more to the local. And I know we have some questions on the floor, but I promised I'd bring Bryn up here, and I would like to get him up there because I think he has a lot to add to this conversation. Why don't you come on up, and I'll brief introduction. Bryn works with he's private practice now, but he's kind of best known in the peak oil and energy worlds for his Dynamic Cities project work. He's one of the first people in the Pacific Northwest, I think, to really, as I mentioned before, start applying the ramifications of peak oil to cities. He's been very involved in local efforts here to talk about peak oil. We only have half an hour, so I'm thinking it will be most interesting for you to talk about is your scenarios planning, which we talked about the other day with Rex, and maybe some of the activities that are happening right here locally.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for having me up. Thanks, guys. That was Warren. That was a fantastic presentation. And Bill? I first learned about peak oil from Bill, and I think it was about 2002 while we were in architecture school, and came out thoroughly depressed at the time. But there is a duality here. We're seeing a real kind of optimism coming out of a lot of people wrestling with the same issue globally, dealing with the same challenges. So I think, you know, this is the defining challenge, dealing with peak oil and climate change as these major drivers going forward. And so I think this is a real opportunity for us. I'm basically an architect with a planning problem habit, you might call it. I work locally designing green buildings, but I've also been working with a loose network of planners through this group, the Dynamic Cities Project, to look at peak oil and climate change. And we've been doing a lot of scenario planning, first as a kind of narrative tool to help people understand how these big picture issues might affect their lives. There's a scenario that was picked up by Rob Hopkins in his transition handbook. And then more recently, we've been doing sort of more analytical scenarios, trying to look at putting some numbers to some of these things. And we did a piece for the Southern California Association of Governments looking at transportation demand going forward and how do we plan our infrastructure, the long-term things that we're investing in today that we'll be relying on in the future. And one of the things coming out of that was this idea that, well, we probably have as much road capacity today as we will ever need or ever be able to use when you start looking at these different oil depletion scenarios. So any investment in additional road capacity beyond what we have today has the potential to become a stranded asset. So what we're trying to do is look at different scenarios for urban planning and bring that back to the kind of nuts and bolts of how we do that. We've been having a conversation locally with the government and so forth about getting a resilient Vancouver task force going to look at a reference scenario, looking at peak oil, climate change, issues like food, water, population, economy, and employment, all of those things under something that's different than the business-as-usual scenario, so that we can then use that analysis to contextualize our current climate planning and all of our other plans. So I think the kind of metrics that you're talking about are hugely important, and I think we need to start looking at what are the real mechanisms that are going to bring about the fundamental change to what is a sustainable future? And I don't think it's necessarily our sustainability policy that gets us there, but our sustainability policy and our individual efforts plants the seeds for what can be radical transformation in the wake of a crisis. So when we look at transportation, high energy prices and recession brings about massive change at a big picture level. So when we look at all of our examples of local food, all these things, we're planting the seeds of radical transformation that will flourish in the vacuum created by a crisis. So as the conventional economy breaks down, the new one will flourish. So I think this idea of building that resiliency capacity is important. But I'll leave it at that. I'm sure you guys want to have a lot of questions for these fantastic presenters. Thanks.
Yeah. And Bryn, what's the website for Dynamic Cities Project?
Dynamiccities.org.
All right, dynamiccities.org. Check it out. Bill whispered to me that he's got 2 points he wanted to respond to with Bryn, and then we'll get the open to questions here.
Sometimes people call me a pessimist. This is an important point because I'm not a pessimist. I'm not an optimist. These are just states of mind that have nothing to do with reality. Okay, you can be as pessimistic as you like. It's not going to change anything if the world's on a golden course. Or you can be as optimistic as you like. And if you're a passenger on the Titanic, you're going to sink anyway. So we want to be realistic in sizing up our situation. And I do that by looking at the numbers. And as I guess Dan mentioned, I have been doing this for some 40 years. The numbers are not getting better. That's just the truth. I'm not trying to make a bad story of it or depress you. But if you don't realize they're getting worse, you don't have a chance to respond to the circumstances in which we are going to find ourselves. So realism simply means opening the opportunity to respond to the real world as it comes at us. And one of the things that's preventing you from finding out about reality is the way we've structured this world so that people who have long since overshot their carrying capacity and live in inherently unsustainable environments are blinded from that reality by the flows of goods and services from other places that they're drawing it down, and so on and so forth. This is not a scenario that is positive. What I'm saying to you is that what is depressing is the way the world is going, the status quo, the business as usual, which is driving these trends that I continue to measure, is a depressing scenario. And I'm trying to break through that and say, look, if we accept these data for what they say and act accordingly, we can pull it off by restructuring our cities in ways that will enable us to survive and to have a future in a sustainable, steady state with a degree of equity that makes life reasonably pleasant for those of us who survive these circumstances. That's optimism. It's not pessimism. That's the first point. The second point is, how many of you have learned or heard about the shipload of Sri Lankans who arrived on our shores in the last couple of days? It reminds us once again that we in North America live in the world's last bliss bubble. Every other place on the planet is overcrowded and deplete. And we only live the way we do because this vast, relatively empty continent, with apologies to the First Nations people, was an inordinate resource warehouse that has sustained Europe and all of us in North America in a material style that has never before been seen on planet Earth. But as I said, we use up all the resources. We are dissipating it as fast as we possibly can without pausing for breath on the growth trajectory that we all think is the norm. So again, that's the truth. Wake up to it. Because other people are beginning to see what we've got and want it in places that can't possibly get it. We have created a mythic model that cannot be sustained on this planet. If everyone lived the way we do, we'd need at least 3 and possibly 4 additional Earth-like planets to achieve that sustainably. It cannot happen on this single planet Earth. So we'd better change our ways and project a model to the other 6.5 billion people on this planet that could be sustained. And it's not the one that they're getting from us. We are not radiating the proper message. The bottom line is that if Let's say if the climate change scenarios are correct, if peak oil is true, there will be, in the lifetimes of many of you in this room, hundreds of millions, if not billions, of refugees on this planet seeking out the best places to go. And they will come, whether we like it or not, by any means possible. And by the way, that includes Americans coming up here to get our energy and everything else that we need to sustain what's left of the United States. Because if the 3 and 4 degree warming scenario, which is now being commonly accepted, it's the most recent study out of Hadley just this week, takes place, then one half of the United States is uninhabitable by the latter part of this century. And that means 200 million people looking for somewhere else to go. So people, this is not, you know, a minor little shift in consciousness. This requires some really hard thinking about what the hell we're going to do in these kinds of circumstances. We create cities today whose basic form will be in place in 50 years. The city we have today, oh, there's a few new buildings, but the form was set 50 years ago. So we need to think 50 years ahead about our urban form and how we're going to live and where the agricultural land is going to be to sustain whatever population it is and so on and so forth. And oh, by the way, what about the 2 million other people who want to move into the neighborhood when India goes belly up or whatever? That's the nature of the game, if the science is correct. Nobody knows for sure, but it sure as hell is playing out the way we said it would 10, 15 years ago. Those are the two things.
Thanks, Bill. Bill, I think the fact that you keep at this with such energy is cause for optimism right there. I know plenty of people who, they dig into peak oil and these other crises, and they just, you know, they give up and they head to the hills. I mean, literally, I know some folks who have moved. This has been fascinating. We have some time for questions. You were very patient, so let's start with you first.
At this point, questions from the public begin. I have amplified those who were near enough to the front microphone so you too can hear. In one case, I will have to summarize a question.
Brian, about the two different tones regarding the eco-cities in China, and Bill mentioning the major errors that goes against the that were in the planning of these cities and goes against its own sustainable goal. And I just wanted to maybe have a few ideas of what the green features of these eco-cities are and how does that relate to maybe the examples that you were mentioning, Warren, on your side.
What are the green features?
The built environment, or do you know what were the green features of these eco-cities or the one that you actually visited, and is this the same example as what Warren was mentioning about the 40.
Well, I'll give an example of a very famous one that isn't built yet. It's being stalled for a variety of reasons. It's called Dongtang. Have any of you heard of Dongtang? Well, all right. So it's a high density. It will be a new city. It will, because of the high density, it gets some of the economies of scale associated with large urban areas. But it's a suburb of Shanghai, and the only access to it is either by luxury boat, because every dwelling in Dongtang has a marina, or car. It's also located in a prime waterfowl area and covering agricultural land. So when I raise this with the developers, no worry, we're going to build greenhouses to replace the agricultural land. But we've studied greenhouses to the nth degree of the kind they're talking about. They use 14 times as much inputs per unit product as a field-grown vegetable in that kind of climate area. So it's not a substitute. They do have, you know, wind power and solar photovoltaics. But, you know, the jury's still out even on photovoltaics yet as to whether over the long term it's a net energy source for a whole variety of reasons. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do it for this application or for that application. But it does mean that if you're going to do it as a major source of energy for any extended period of time, you better be very careful about the circumstances in which you're putting it. So there's many reasons to be doubtful and optimistic about the Dongtang kind of development. But it's not going ahead at this point in any case. Another one, I already mentioned one that I thought it was just a complete planning disaster. And it's fully constructed.
Yeah, Dongtang is not going to happen at all. There was corruption, and it's just not going to be built. It was ballyhooed around the world for a few years, and it's not happening. Tianjin looks to be the most likely first model of the new eco-city that they're going to build, and a district of Tianjin. And that's one of the 40 new eco-city districts I mentioned. Some of the metrics they have now for these districts, and these districts will be up to 500,000 people, are 90% walkability, bikeability, and public transit use. So 10% automobile use within these districts. They're going for 20% renewable energy, not very much at all. I mean, California is shooting for 30% by 2020. In fact, it's state law. California is going to have 30% all renewable energy by 2020. So they're all, you know, it's very minimal goal of renewable, because they're so dependent on coal in China for power. There's not much in terms of local food. They are going to try to do some things with local food in Tianjin. The metrics are cloudy, though. They're very, you know. So those are the, that's what stands out to me. Green building principles, China is developing the three-star standard. They're finalizing, or they're going to try to finalize that within the next year. It's their own green building standard. So it looks like there's going to be three international green building standards. There's going to be LEED, there's going to be China's three-star, and then the European standard, BREEAM. That's where China is with their metrics right now. They need a lot of help there, but they're really willing to look at a lot of people's ideas right now. One firm, I can't mention who they are, they're developing a prototype of a city of like 20,000 people that could scale up to 1 million using renewable energy, geothermal energy, and they control the technology in this one area. It could be feasible. Greenhouses being heated with solar, thermal energy, not PV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they've looked at algae as a fuel source, as an energy source, and as a waste. You know, it's a circular ecosystem in some ways. And the Chinese are interested in this company's or this outfit's approach. They're also looking at worldwide. There are cities being designed now that can withstand floods. Especially in Indonesia, there's a city of 500,000 that might have to be rebuilt because it sits at the confluence of about 15 rivers and the water's rising. So the new vernacular for architecture for cities near the ocean is going to be a 5-meter lower level that's sort of expendable. And the Chinese are considering that with their coastal cities as well now. They're looking at everything, which to their credit is something that, you know, a country like the United States would say, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that's silly and you're crazy. China's saying, well, yeah, I mean, this could happen, or we're building cities for 50 years. These are the inputs we need to look at. So there's a lot more to that.
I just have to add a couple of points here.
Again, please make it quick, though, because we've got only 15 minutes.
Without taking anything away of what Warren said, every increment of growth in China is based on the idea of rising incomes. And it doesn't matter how they build the cities. Even if they're 50% more efficient than they would otherwise have been, it's on top of what's already out there, which is already too much. What the world needs is an 80% reduction in absolute terms in its material and energy throughput. And that's basically fossil fuel use. Growing more sustainably doesn't cut it. LEED is growth. It doesn't cut it. It's growing more sustainably. Getting more efficiently unsustainable doesn't cut it. So these kinds of building standards, however better they might be than the building that would have been in their absence, are simply not taking us in the direction we need to go. And by the way, I've come across in the context of LEED a number of instances where, because the building was purportedly going to save 20% or 25% in this way, why don't we just add another couple of floors? So what you wind up is a kind of rebound effect that eliminates the impact savings that would have been there had they just gone ahead with the original plan. One of them I just discovered this past weekend. Now, the point is that there are many, many dynamics at play here that take our eyes off the fundamental goal of reducing in absolute terms the energy throughput in our economy and a lot of the material throughput by 80%. Growing more efficiently at the margin is still going in the wrong direction.
Brandon had a comment too.
Yeah, just that in general, green building, it's sort of a harm reduction strategy in terms of you're trying to lessen the impact of building from here to here. If you're talking about peak oil or climate change, we're trying to actually get some sort of net impact on the aggregate, you know, emissions or whatever other metric you want to look at. So as one example in the development projects that I work on, we look at can the project become net positive? And what that almost always means is having some element of renovation or replacement of the existing building stock as a fundamental component of every built project. So we're building laneway houses, and as part of that, we're trying to build a super efficient laneway house, but also do sufficient energy upgrades to the existing main house that the whole site at the end has, say, 10% fewer emissions or 10% lower energy reduction than before we did our project. So our economic activity is being leveraged to have a net positive impact. And I think we need to start thinking about not just relative improvement, about how this new building is 10% better than another new building, but looking at our city as it is and how we need to transform much of our existing building and existing infrastructure to be more efficient in place. And I think it's a fundamentally different kind of mindset, and it's one that's going to have to come forward if we want to wrestle with peak oil, climate change, any of these other big issues.
Yeah. We could have done a whole session on smart growth and a new concept called smart decline, which I don't even attempt to get into. We have a couple questions. Let's start with you. You were first.
Have you read Kunstler's book, The World in My Hands, where he sort of suggested, you know, in this, it gets very dire. Probably, Bill, as you're suggesting, state governments will just end up collapsing. You know, Albany is just sort of a ghost town, and there are, you know, spontaneously organized sort of local governments. But to maybe avoid that sort of apocalyptic vision, and talking about Brin's notion of planting seeds of revolutionary change, do you have any thoughts on how we might plant some of those seeds now to evolve into the political system that you're talking about, this sort of city-state, or I've heard other people refer to it as municipal federalism?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've only begun the dialogue. Democracies only work when there's an engaged, fully informed population willing to get out there and talk about these things at the political rallies and all the rest of it. Nothing is going to happen in the directions we want as long as even Obama stands up 2 weeks ago and say the government in Washington is run by the lobbies. That is to say, the major vested interests who are literally paying hundreds of millions of dollars to maintain their control over Congress. The same thing is going on in Ottawa. If you have paid any attention to the number of registered lobbyists who now essentially dictate what our governments can do on our behalf, it's appalling. But most people don't care. We don't even care enough to vote anymore in this country. So I think we're not going to see the kinds of changes you've asked about, certainly nothing I'm talking about, until people have a greater sense of their own engagement in the political process in order to conserve or preserve themselves from the worst consequences of what will happen if we don't get engaged in that process. So the first thing we need to do is politicize the population, and I hope we can do that without catastrophe, because actually it's mostly catastrophe that engages people in being interested in civic affairs, which is an appalling condemnation of human nature.
A woman from the back of the room asks a question about the relationship between peak oil, suburban land use, and local food production. She also notes that cities promoting eco-density are not keeping up with the needs of children. Warren Karlenzig, whose book How Green Is Your City? Rates American Places to Live, has already said that the majority of Americans are found in the suburbs, not in big cities. He fields the first part of the question, followed by guest panelist Bryn Davidson, and then Bill Reese.
Anyone want to take that?
Well, the suburbs will have to be redesigned if we're going to make resilient urbanism a reality. I mean, because it's the majority of it. I mean, the big cities are great models, though, and great ways. They have the money, too, to do it in some cases. And they have the citizens that are interested and knowledgeable and trained or acquire the training to do it. And the suburbs, you know, they're commuting so much, they don't have time even to think about it. But, you know, that's the good thing about transferring the model of knowledge from the cities to the suburbs and the exurbs, is that it's got to be done. Otherwise, it's, you know, you're fighting a losing battle, because only 20% of the people are in big cities in the United States. The rest are in small towns or suburbs around cities. That's critical. I don't know what any other components of
yeah. Bryn, you think a lot about
redesign. I think there will be some suburbs that basically become ghost towns. I think there will be others, though, where there's enough of an economy functioning regionally that you can have single-income families, where you have one person who's continuing to be engaged in the sort of global petro economy as it transitions, and one person engaged in the local economy. And I think one of the things we can look at in terms of building a kind of resiliency is figuring out, as a family, can you start to function on a single income? I know in the case of my wife and I, we bought an extraordinarily tiny condo, but it means that we can function on a single income. And so a year ago when the economy collapsed and I lost all of my architecture work, there's the ability to kind of re-transform your business and engage in a new type of work on a local level. So when we're looking at scaling up local food production, making your own products, all these other kind of things, I think there's a capacity to do that if there is an ability to function with as a single income family.
By the way, that's a perfect example of a very small scale panarchy cycle where, you know, he had a certain income dependent on the architectural surface that collapsed, but there was sufficient resilience and redundancy in the family unit to recover and go up that trajectory on a different economic pathway. So these things operate at all of those scales. But you need the capacity and the support to do that.
And you need education in agriculture more. I mean, no one knows about fruit trees even. You know, that people in our who live near me have fruit trees and they don't know it's fruit. Their children don't know. They think it's poison or something. And I'm serious. And berries and figs and, you know, other fruit, it's unbelievable. There's great ignorance. But if you educate people more about, and children especially, about what food is and how it's produced and how it needs soil and how it needs water and how you take care of it, how you prune a fruit tree, you need to have that. And there's so many trees and things producing food in our suburbs, and they're not even used, or let alone the space that could have fruit planted. And that's an element of education that isn't being addressed.
Is that what they call it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked with David in the early 90s in projects in industrial ecology, and I know.
Just to go to your point about children in cities and so on, if you look at the area around Arbutus and 12th, Arbutus Walk, I think that area is called, where you cut off every second street and turn it into neighborhood land, you can free up an enormous quantity of land for playgrounds or structured activities for children or agriculture if we chose to do that. So there's all sorts of options. About a third or more, about 40% of Vancouver's surface area is dedicated to the automobile. We say there's a land shortage. There's no land shortage. It's a total misallocation of the land base that could be evolved into all sorts of wonderful things.
I want to get one more question because that's all we have time for, and I know there are some folks who have been waiting. Sir?
Yeah, I was wondering, now that we have the mainstream media engaged with engaging with climate change, and not nearly to the extent that it should, how do we inject people into that discussion? I think this is still pathetic.
That's I can let me speak to that very quickly because that's a very timely question. The annual conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil in the United States had their annual conference just last week. And some of my colleagues went down there, and I know there were some conversations had. And a number of the conversations were around, is peak oil as a messaging frame even relevant anymore? And one of the big reasons for why it might not be relevant is because there is the argument to be made that we essentially hit peak oil or functional peak oil in terms of messaging last year. It's a has-been, and it's already been adopted in many ways. So that then begs the question, well, if we don't use that term peak oil, what do we use? You're all peak oil experts up here, especially you, Bryn. What do you think about using the term peak oil?
Well, I think the peak oil is definitely a loaded term, and in some audiences, people will kind of cringe when you say peak oil. So you dance around it and you say oil depletion or energy scarcity or whatever you need to do to make it sort of comfortable. I find scenarios to be very powerful tools in terms of engaging skeptical audiences because you're not necessarily saying that you know exactly what's going to happen. But you can say, here's a plausible scenario and here are the implications. Now, I think peak oil is critical to the climate change discussion because I think ultimately peak oil will drive the change in our society, and it will be climate change will in some way be a litmus test for the solutions that we apply to peak oil. When we look at the things that really impact us, the price of energy, transportation, the economy, I think peak oil has a potential to impact us at 10 times the scale in the short term. In terms of how those two issues overlap, There are many things that we're doing in response to peak oil that are terrible for climate change. Tar sands, expanded drilling, cutting down the rainforest for biofuels. All these things we're doing in response to peak oil that are very bad for climate change. On the flip side of that, there are many things that we're doing for climate change that do nothing to address oil dependence. So if you spend money planting trees or trying to put a giant mirror in space, that's money that you could be spending making your local economy, your local food system, less dependent on oil. So I think that when we start looking at peak oil, it brings in a piece about resiliency, about economic and social resiliency, that is very different than just talking about environmental or moral good. And so the audience that you can reach out to bringing those two together is much broader, I think, than when you just talk about climate change. Just as one example, at one of the peak oil conferences, the guy stands up, and he's a Republican business investor guy. He says he doesn't care much about climate change, but he told his wife that they should get a Prius. And she says, why? We can afford gas, even if it's $5 a gallon, we can afford it. He says, well, when rationing comes into effect and we get 10 gallons a month or whatever it is, we're going to go four times as far in our Prius as we are in our current car. So I think once we start looking at the real mechanisms of change, I see that as recession, rationing, shortage, and price spikes, that the decision-making process and who we engage in this process becomes very different. So I think that, you know, Bill obviously wants to say something, but I think that peak oil, I think, is a critical component of the energy transition dialogue about how we transition away from fossil fuels. It defines the mechanisms, the speed, what comes first.
I must say, we're pretty much out of time, so I want to use the remaining seconds before they kick us out to get final comments. So maybe Bill and then and Warren. And also,
I want you all to notice what Bryn identified as the movers of change here. And every one of them is a disaster scenario. Right? Am I not correct?
You said movers of change at scale.
But the point is, isn't it a rather sad comment on the state of the human species, the so-called most evidence of intelligent life on Earth, that we respond mostly to negative pressures, higher prices, social catastrophe.
We're case strategists.
But that's right. So what I'm actually doing is I'm trying to plan. Say, look, there's two ways of going down. You can go down in a chaotic, uncontrolled manner, or you can plan your descent so that you have a soft landing. That's really what we're talking about here. So that's what planning is all about. And planning down is now a viable strategy. On the question of the connection between climate change and peak oil, the most recent climate change data suggests that if we're to avoid a 650 parts per million CO2, we're now at 300 almost, should be down around 350. No, we're almost 400. We should be down below 350. Yeah. So the point is we're headed toward twice the current level. And to avoid that, we need to begin about a 6% reduction per annum in the OECD countries, of which Canada is one. Well, the good news is that that's about the rate at which oil fields are being depleted, so that production of oil may decline in pace with our need to reduce our consumption thereof.
All right. Warren, final thoughts?
I think that there just needs to be far more education in the media, at universities, at grade schools, at every level, and conversations with people you know about what is happening. There's not enough knowledge about it. I mean, last week we got hit by a typhoon in Northern California that came from Japan. That's happened one other time in history. It rained 20 inches in one spot in 24 hours. We're going to start seeing those oddities of nature hit home in our own cities, in our own towns, in our own states, in our own countries more and more and more. And we have to start recognizing that it's going to transform our lives, you know, before we leave this planet, wherever we go. I think peak oil is a tough term. You know, some people do discount you if you use it. Peaking oil is a good one to use, or peaking resources. I think that's what we need to get at. No one can argue with that. Fisheries are declining, soil's declining, water's declining, et cetera. You know, uncontaminated bodies are declining because children are born now with a body burden far beyond anything we could ever imagine. You know, all these things point at let's use our resources in a much smarter way in our own lives, in our towns, in our cities, and at the government level. The government is probably going to be last, though, I must say. You know, whether it's local government or national government or international agencies, I've worked with them all, and they follow. But in the United States, the Green Cities movement really was the only thing going on during the Bush administration in terms of environmental or sustainability thinking and planning and doing. So there's a lot to be said for local action and its impact on government, on media, on messaging, and on our lives. You have to use all those things and just keep at it.
Well, I want to thank Warren Kalenzig, Bill Reese, and Bryn Davidson for a very, very interesting panel discussion. Please visit our website, and thanks for coming.
You have been listening to a panel question and answer period titled Urban Resilience in a Post-Carbon World. The host was author Daniel Lurch and the Post-Carbon Institute. Speakers were Canadian scientist Dr. Bill Reese and California Green City guru Warren Kalenzig, along with the guest Peak Oil spokesperson Bryn Davidson. The recording, flawed as it is, was made by Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The opening presentations by Warren Kalenzig and Bill Reese are available as free MP3 downloads from the city's page at ecoshock.org or from postcarbon.org. You will also find this Q&A session there. For more information on the whole thing, go to postcarbon.org.